Chapter 20, Continued.
Bethany stayed close, or perhaps it was the other way around, he staying close to her. They shifted and turned and traversed together through the evening, like September leaves on the surface of the water, bound by their likeness and moving with a silent tide. They did not touch one another much. They did not hold hands and such, as they had in the park. Although when she laughed, which was delightfully often this evening, given Hollis's irreverent repartee with his guests and his humorously apocryphal memory in such settings, she tended to grip his shoulder with one of her hands. She did this not with any particular force or urgency, but just enough to steady herself, as if in the swell of laughter from those around them and in the tumult of her own mirth, Bethany longed for some physical support or confirmation that Hollis was actually flesh and blood. Tilly's celebratory teleconference ended abruptly as his youngest son, in a fit of overexuberance that will sometimes take hold of him in groups of people, danced Mei Chang across the telephone and into the coffee table. The phone let out a high-pitched electronic shrieking sound and splintered into shards of bone-colored plastic beneath Ben's foot before going completely dead and silencing Tilly mid-word.
What?
Hollis had tried to catch them as they fell, but Mei's struggle to free her arms spun them in the other direction, glancing off an arm of the couch and directly into the table. Her head made a hollow thock sound as it connected with the sturdy wooden frame. Susan had warned Hollis not to place the phone in the middle of the floor, albeit entirely for reasons of aesthetics, having nothing whatsoever to do with safety. He was certain to be reminded later, tomorrow maybe, that she had told him it was a bad idea. The fact that no one could have possibly foreseen these events would not be relevant. If Mei ever lost consciousness, Hollis could not tell. He was kneeling at her side in an instant, pulling Ben off her, handing him off to Susan, and then tending to Mei. He rolled her over carefully by the shoulders, and she looked up at him from the carpet, eyes wide and unseeing. Hollis sensed Bethany immediately behind him, as if they had lunged together to avert disaster. She kneeled next to him, one hand on his shoulder, the other finding and stroking May's arm.
Mei! Mei!
Said Bethany, like a nightingale, like an angel. Are you hurt?
Mei? Can you hear me? Hollis asked, his voice firm and brimming with take-charge authority.
She blinked at them, slowly, saying nothing.
Okay, let's give her some air, said Dr. Swenson, calmly from behind. Let me take a look.
Hollis stood to let him in and shepherded his guests back toward the dining room, where they all watched in silence, as Dr. Swenson checked for signs of a concussion. David hovered over them nervously, squatting and standing, wanting to do something, but obviously having no idea what that might be. After a few moments, Mei sat up with Dr. Swenson on one side and David on the other. She blinked slowly and seemed to take stock of her surroundings. She touched her head above the eye gingerly and winced. A few moments after that, she was able to stand. The guests applauded, as though it had all been for their amusement. She smiled meekly and sat down on the couch, David like a second skin.
"You'll have a headache tonight and a hell of a bruise tomorrow, but I think you're fine," said Bill Swenson. "If this couch hadn't broken your fall, you'd probably be in the hospital. And you missed that corner by inches."
Hollis was rummaging through a drawer in the hallway bureau for some ibuprofen when the phone rang. He looked around for Susan, but she had not yet returned to the party. She was still in the back bedroom with Ben, who was certain to be upset, calming him as only she could, putting him back together, holding him, rocking him.
"Beth," he said, suddenly loving the sound of what he resolved would be his name for her. "I've got to get that. Somewhere in here is a bottle of Advil. Will you?"
"Go," she said, kneeling and slipping her hands into the drawer of plastic pill bottles and adhesive bandage cans and ointment sprays.
As he made his way to the phone, Hollis thought of Ben and smiled, reconnecting with the feelings he had been forced to abandon as May had plummeted to her fate. He found again his swell of emotion in the first moment Ben had appeared in the foyer, intercepting May Chang in mid-retreat for the door, enfolding her in his doughy arms and dancing with her, clapping her arms to her sides and spinning her around in circles. More than the dancing and spinning, it was the look of unmitigated joy on Ben's face that Hollis now remembered. It was possible for Hollis, in his mind's eye, to isolate that look, to carry it with him and to consider it quietly, without the distractions of May's plaintive cries and useless thrashing to free herself. In that look, with his mouth open in laughter and his eyes lit from within, Ben had given Hollis a glimpse of his own burgeoning emotion, as though reflecting his own heart, which all evening had been filling with a feeling that had yet no name, origin, or destination, but that now had a look.
Hello?
Dad, what the hell happened?
Hollis explained to Tilly the situation with a practiced calm, pouring himself a glass of Chablis as he spoke. Everything was fine, he told her. A bump on the head, nothing serious. The speakerphone had met an untimely demise, but all the humans were okay. Mom was taking care of Ben. Beth was getting May some aspirin.
So I guess that's that,
she said when he was done. Guess so.
Tell Mom to call me, you know, whenever.
Will do.
And oh, tell everyone there I said thank you for the party.
Mm-hmm.
Okay then, bye Dad.
Bye. Hollis glanced at his watch. It was suddenly later than he thought. It was time. When he returned to the living room, the party seemed to be on its way back to full swing, conversations overlapping and tangling in the air as they fought for dominance. Harris Pinkle and the Taylors were picking at the hors d'oeuvres and commiserating over the scourge of liberal blame-laying in all matters concerning the war in Iraq.
It's not fair to the troops, Harris was saying. We're there, and they ought to just shut up about missing WMDs. We can't pull out now. Democracy never comes cheap or easy. Does it, Hollis?
Unskewering a mushroom into his mouth, Hollis nodded his head in agreement and kept moving. Dana Swenson was talking real estate with Mickey and Jude Dobbs, suggesting that the notion of a bubble of artificially inflated property values was mostly a myth.
People have been trained to think that a bust will always follow a boom, that bad news always follows good, but that's not necessarily true for property values. Not true in Columbus, not true in Cleveland. Here, ask Hollis, he'll tell you.
What will I tell them?
That the bubble theory applied to property values is a myth.
It is a myth, Hollis said. I gotta run. Nice to see you tonight.
You're leaving? Asked Jude. Hollis kept moving, heading for the center of the room toward the knot of people clustered around May Chang, who was still seated on the sofa. He wisely charted an avoidant course around Peaches Pinkle, who was taking strong issue with Rhonda Davenport over the sexual potency of Gene Hackman. David, Susan, Gail the lesbian interloper, Bill Swenson, and Bethany all looked at him as he approached.
How are we feeling?
He asked May, just a little too chipper, patting her on the knee.
Her head is going to hurt like the dickens,
Bill answered for her.
But she'll be okay. I don't think she's got a concussion.
David, who had perched himself on the edge of the assaultive table, reached for May's hand, but she pulled it away. Poor bastard, Hollis thought. Somehow, David would get the blame for all this. Not even May knew yet why it was David's fault, but she would know for certain before the night was over, and then David would know. That's just the way it worked. David needed to grow some thicker skin, be his own man. He worried too much about what others thought of him, too vulnerable to misplaced guilt. He clapped David on the shoulder and winked, knowing that would say it all.
Well, that's fortunate, said Hollis, pointing sternly at May, because concussions are strictly prohibited in this house.
May did something with her mouth that Hollis chose to interpret as a smile. Turning to Susan, he said, How's Ben?
Upset, but okay, she reported. He's calmer now.
I found the aspirin, Hollis, reported Bethany, suddenly between them. I just gave her the whole bottle to keep with her.
Perfect. Thanks, Beth. You ready to get going?
Going, said Bethany. Where?
Going, said Susan, just a little louder.
You're leaving?
Mm-hmm.
But the dinner, you're leaving before dinner?
Mm-hmm.
Hollis, where exactly are you going?
Little surprise for Beth.
A surprise? Exclaimed Bethany, her face brightening. Really? Oh, Hollis, you really are too much. What have you done now?
Susan, her body language at war with itself, crossed her arms tightly and smiled like a cleaving glacier, exposing her teeth, as though she too was enthralled with Hollis's unpredictability and the mystery of what he could possibly have in store. Even if Susan had intended to fool her guests, she clearly had no intention of fooling Hollis, and he was not fooled. Hollis knew she was upset. He had always known that she would be upset. He even knew that by the time they ultimately started fighting about this evening, tomorrow, or the next day, Susan will have carefully framed her objection.
I don't care if you want to leave, Hollis, she will say. That's not the point. It's just a matter of common courtesy to let me know ahead of time.
But that would all be a carefully constructed post hoc rationalization. Susan's irritation had nothing whatsoever to do with common courtesy. It had everything to do with his freedom from her agenda. The party had always been her deal, not his.
He had been very clear about that fact.
She had elected to throw the party anyway. He was not going out of his way to be difficult. Had circumstances been different, he certainly would have been around to help pry the tumbler out of Peaches's hand and bid them all a fond farewell. He would have washed the dishes and straightened the living room. But circumstances were not different, and he had stayed as long as those circumstances would reasonably permit. Hell, he had been there for Tilly. That's what mattered, wasn't it? Susan should be satisfied. She should be satisfied, but she wouldn't be satisfied. In fact, she would be secretly angry that she could not accuse him of skipping out on his own daughter. He expected nothing rational from her on this subject. And that was all okay. He had the thick skin David lacked. Susan would be fine.
Okay, he said, addressing the group of them together.
Here's the deal. This afternoon when I was out picking up wine for the party, I bumped into Simon Neal. Simon Neal is the executive vice president of the bank. He said to say hello, by the way, Susan, and to tell you that Janice is going to stay in Capistrano for another month and will call you when she gets back.
Susan, still smiling, blinked once, very, very slowly, as though suddenly inhabited by a Disney animatronic.
Hollis turned his attention to Bethany and continued.
Anyway, Simon told me that Wally Nunn, another VP, is retiring. Turns out his retirement party is tonight over at the Blackwell. Started about, an hour or so ago. Simon asked what I had been up to, and I mentioned that I was helping a brilliant young mind find its place in the halls of Ohio Academe. And further, he said, holding up a finger, that I was helping to find said brilliant young mind a path to future employment. Simon told me that OFSC was revamping its internship program, and said that Vernon Ashe has made that his mission, and that Vernon would be very interested in talking to you. He poked her in the shoulder.
Bethany gasped. What?
He said that I should bring you by tonight since everyone will be there. Hollis spread his arms in the direction of the brilliant young mind. What do you think, Beth?
There was a moment of incomprehension on Bethany's face.
Hollis, oh my God, I can't believe you. You're, oh my God.
She threw her arms around the tops of his shoulders, pressing the warmth of her cheek against his.
I don't even know what to say.
They parted, and she looked at him, searching his eyes.
Am I ready for this? I mean, I haven't taken a single business class. I'm not even...
Ah, Hollis waved away her concerns. Relax. Of course you're ready.
but we need to go before they all get too drunk to remember you."
David, May, and Dr. Swenson turned to the question of how much ibuprofen one could safely ingest in a single 24-hour period. They spoke in softer tones, as if to tacitly encourage that the other conversation proceed without them. Susan looked down at the carpet, averting her attention from Bethany's gush of gratitude. She towed a string of lint into the carpet until it was gone from view. When she looked up again, she found Gail looking back at her with a face of solidarity and indignant incomprehension. Susan rolled her eyes and smiled, patting Gail on the forearm and waving away the new developments with all those things in life that are not really new and that cannot be helped.
"That's certainly exciting news, Bethany," Susan said.
"I know, I just can't believe this."
"Well, look, don't be any later than you already are. You two should get going. It was wonderful to meet you. Thanks very much for coming tonight."
Hollis kissed his wife on the cheek, turned, and then, lightly touching Bethany on her yellow elbow, made his way for the door, slapping backs and pumping hands as he moved through the room. When he reached the very spot in the foyer where May Chang's evening had turned precipitously south, he waved grandly at his friends and family, as though he were boarding a cruise ship. A jumbled chorus of voices and arms returned the gesture.
"You all enjoy yourselves and enjoy the dinner. Tilly called a moment ago and wanted me to thank all of you for coming to celebrate her success. So yes, thanks. We really do appreciate it."
Then he singled out Susan, who was still smiling ferociously at them.
"Honey, I've got my cell phone if you need anything. And oh, just leave the dishes. I'll do them when I get home."
"Ah, what a guy,"
Mickey Dobbs was saying, as the door closed behind them. They stepped from the house into a column of dark autumn air that, upon the closing of the door, seemed to fall upon their shoulders like a single cloak of heavy velvet. Hollis pulled a long, slow breath as they crossed onto the driveway, feeling strangely free, almost kingly. The evening was suddenly intimate and formal and slightly electric. He tucked Bethany into the car, and she beamed up at him in gratitude for all he was doing and all that he was. He drove to the Blackwell Intercontinental Hotel on a thick cushion of self-satisfaction. It was the pulse of magnanimity beating in his chest and the blood of a benefactor in his veins. He had helped his good friend Akahito Takata. Not just a perfunctory gesture, but more than anyone could reasonably have expected of him. He had devoted entire days to Bethany's cause. Not just showing her colleges and lending his name and knowledge to what would turn out to be important introductions, but showing her his beloved Ohio. He had given of his own life and experience and wisdom for her benefit. He had welcomed Bethany into his own home, bringing her within the fold of his family and friends. And he was now whisking her through the night beneath a fulsome autumnal moon that silvered the I-70 and the inside track to an opportunity that only he could have arranged. The middle lane cleared, and Hollis seized the opportunity to accelerate around the doddering station wagon with the broken taillight and the chaotic collage of sneeringly clever bumper stickers that had been holding his attention captive. "He's a divider, not a uniter," and "Jesus was a liberal," and "Make levies, not war," and 51% is not a mandate, and "If you aren't absolutely appalled, then you haven't been paying attention." And the one Hollis could not begin to understand, but was just as eager to put behind him. Cheney Palpatine, 2008. He was driving much faster than necessary, but it felt good. He felt good. He was good. His colleagues at OFSC would certainly be pleased and grateful to have someone like Bethany Cohen in their midst. After all, what is there not to like about Bethany Cohen? Sharp as a tack, a quick learner, a good sense of values, and wise beyond her years.
She would start at the bottom, of course, while she got her education, learning the paperwork and working the phones. But she would move up fast. He looked at her in the passenger seat next to him. Suki. Bethany. Beth. Pulling a tiny brush through her perfect blonde mane and poking around in her purse for lipstick. She would move fast, all right. With her charm and smarts, she would soon be everybody's favorite assistant deal closer. They'd be lining up to work with her, to teach her, each vying to be the one who shows her the way. The assistive role would be but a short-lived pit stop. She would keep moving. She'd steer clear of the home mortgage department, of course, and escrow and consumer loans. He would make sure of that. Beth was made for better things and higher places. She'd go straight into commercial loans, just as he had, rolling with the big boys and the big money, making the deals that made the city, and letting someone else cross the T's and dot the I's in order to close them up and file them away. But Bethany would not likely content herself with the deals that made the city. She would not limit her sights to Columbus or even Ohio. Her intimate connection with Japanese banking and with the great Akihito Takada would, with the right guidance from a certain benefactor, launch her and OFSC into the heady realm of international finance. Deals would be made, alliances forged, markets opened. Of course, Hollis's trusted association with all parties suggested the likelihood that he would serve an integral role in those developments. If called upon to serve for such purposes, he would certainly lend his assistance. But that was an incidental consideration. His role, if any, was dependent on the interwoven fate of his protege and his former employer. With any luck, after a few years of raking in the money, Bethany Cohen would be an officer and a director. And OFSC, in the span of one person's career, would be a different bank than the one from which Hollis had retired. He smiled a little at this thought. OFSC would finally be on the map and would owe its success, in some small way, to him. To Hollis Johns. To his foresight. To his willingness to do the right thing for the right person at the right time. All of that was a long way off, of course. And really, who knew for certain what would come of his efforts on Bethany's behalf? But Hollis could now see this future so clearly in the headlights that it was difficult to imagine any other. Bethany was quiet, surprisingly so. She stared out the window at the traffic as she twirled the strap of her purse around her finger. "You okay there, Beth?" he asked.
"Hmm? Oh, yeah, yeah. This is really... God, this is so exciting, Hollis."
She leaned over and squeezed his arm with both hands.
"I guess I'm still kind of shocked."
"Well, I think this might be a good opportunity for you. OFSC is a good organization. Top people. You'll like them."
He gave her knee a reassuring squeeze.
"And I know they're going to like you. You're not nervous, are you?"
"A little," she confessed with a laugh.
"I thought so.
Don't you worry about a thing." Whatever nervousness Bethany was feeling seemed to Hollis to have dissipated by the time State Highway 315 crossed the Olentangy River Road, and they began gliding along Tuttle Park Place, back toward the OSU campus. Perhaps, he surmised, the trip was reminding her of their first day together. Not the actual first day, in the Marriott Lobby restaurant, a lifetime ago when he still thought of her as Suki Takada, but her first day out as Bethany Cohen. When she had so impressed him and Fawn Sherwood at OSU with her potential as a student of business. The day of the waffles and the park and the gardens and the bonsai. The day they had held hands on the way back to the car.
"Did you meditate this morning?" he asked.
She laughed her beautiful laugh and buried her face in her hands, confessing that she had slept in and not seen the sunrise.
"Every day, every day, every day," he said playfully. "It's important."
"I know, I know. Oh, Hollis, I'm terrible."
What am I gonna do with you, Beth?
Wally Nunn's retirement party was at full throttle when they arrived. The banquet room, one of the smaller offered by the Blackwell, was full of people and jostling with raucous merriment. A swing band was busy overworking a medley of Benny Goodman hits from across the room. Hollis could pick out voices here and there that he recognized, and then the faces of his old colleagues, here somehow alien and out of context, started to leap out at him. There was Nancy, and there was Michael Wolfe, and Bernard, and Michael Richards, and Gabe, and Barbara, and Lewis. One by one they came back to him, these faces that used to be so familiar, so much the intimate cast that populated his daily life. They all looked the same now, that he really looked at them as they went about eating and talking and dancing, oblivious to his presence. The same, and yet. They stood and watched for a moment, as though on a beach just out of reach of the breakers, before venturing in. A uniformed man with a bottle poured them each a glass of wine. Hollis put his arm around Bethany's shoulder and gave it a reassuring squeeze, sensing her trepidation. At the far end of the ballroom, heads and arms were visible through the crowd, spinning and bobbing and flailing like people drowning in a rhythmic undertow. A sure sign of bankers cutting loose. It took a few minutes before people began to notice Hollis standing in the bank of doorways next to a woman in yellow that they did not know. But eventually, their distracted attention lingered long enough to trigger recognition, and he was soon awash in glad-handing and hugging and good-natured exclamations.
"Hey, Hollis! How the hell you been? Where you been hiding yourself?"
Hollis had not attended a company function since his retirement, but he had imagined doing so. He had imagined his return. Hollis, the avuncular elder statesman. Hollis, the approachable icon of the good old days. Hollis, the beloved mentor who always had the time and the solution. Hollis, who had heroically lobbied the board to stop the merger. Hollis, who had come up in the days when OFSC was making its name and banks were still banks, and not financial department stores hawking insurance and investment tips. Hollis, the deal-making legend who knew absolutely everyone. The reality now compared strangely to what he had imagined. The greetings were friendly, even effusive, but casually so, fleeting, and not as reverential or reminiscent as they might have been. All was in passing. Delightful impromptu interludes with an old pal. Social detours on the way to the buffet or the bar or the dance floor. Of course, it was the environment. The party, the people, the music. All of the celebratory commotion would allow only but so much personal attention. He knew that. He knew that. At each turn, Hollis found himself explaining how much he was enjoying his retirement. So much more time to explore what the workaday world would never allow. The reading and the studying of many topics that interested him. More quality time with his family, which, he reminded them, was very important to him. And the travel. Serious travel that he and Susan were planning. Still in the thinking stages, of course, but there would be some serious traveling. There was just so much to see and do in the world. He was seriously thinking about Tibet. He was looking into Lhasa. They were happy to see him, he thought. They seemed happy to see him. They acted that way. But the din of conversation and the music and the ebb and flow of people prevented interactions of any depth and made for little more than a series of shallow and less than satisfying exchanges. As soon as a conversation threatened to turn meaningful, someone else would wander by and the frothy ritual of surprised recognition, fervid greeting, and the "how's retirement in 50 words or less" confabulation started anew. Some of them noted Tilly's nomination, to which he offered a falsely modest shrug and declared that he and Susan had not been particularly surprised. "Oh, Tilly's going places," he told Stuart and Pam Williams. "We've always known that. It was always just a matter of time." Some of them asked about the kids, generally,
to which he responded that they were all doing exceptionally well.
Tilly's got her sights on an Oscar. David is teaching the hell out of those kids at Wilson High, and he's considering taking his talent to the university level, where it will be better rewarded and appreciated.
He did not receive any inquiries about Ben, and this was no great surprise. Most people had no reason to know of Ben. Those who did know of Ben found it more comfortable to avoid entirely the subject of Down syndrome, something they did not understand and did not want to catch by association. Not that they didn't care. Certainly they cared. But what if something was wrong? What if this syndrome was acting up? What if some medical or developmental unpleasantness was transpiring? Why make Hollis share all that misfortune? Really, why get into all that?
Hollis, as every member of the Johns family, was used to the avoidance spawned by such discomfort, and it no longer bothered or surprised him.
What did surprise him a little was that very few people made any inquiries about Susan. His wife had come to know most of the older guard at OFSC over the years, and she seemed to Hollis to be rather highly regarded by his colleagues. Granted, those relationships were largely superficial and infrequently tended, forged mostly over cocktails at holiday parties and hot dogs at the annual barbecues. But still, even Patty Osgood from accounting and Steve Riesling from escrow, who had always seemed to have something they wanted him to pass along to Susan, failed to acknowledge her existence tonight. The last any of them had seen of Susan had been at Starling's, the scene of his own retirement party. It had been an elegant but much more subdued affair. Dinner and drinks above the winking lights of Columbus, attended mostly by the commercial loan department and a few from administration, and several members of the board. Wally Nunn, not among them. A few laudatory speeches had punctuated an evening of reminiscing and some very expensive wine. It had been a more intimate, meaningful send-off than the extravagant hullabaloo for Wally Nunn that was now raging about him. And they had all so easily made Susan an integral part of that evening, as though the social proceedings embedded a ritual of return, of re-entrusting his care back to his wife. Susan had stayed close at his side, raising her glass, holding his hand, answering their call to receive him and to give him what they no longer could. "Help me! What am I supposed to do with him?" she had joked, and they had laughed with her and mockingly refused to take him back. They had closed down the restaurant that evening, 5 or 6 of them outlasting all the others, leaning back in their chairs and telling war stories and drinking, all of them seemingly unwilling to let the night go spinning into the next era. And Susan had been a part of all that. But tonight, strangely, Susan, like Ben, was never mentioned by anyone other than Hollis. That the apparent lack of interest in Susan might have had something to do with the stunning young figure at his side, her arm draped comfortably through the bend in his own, never occurred to Hollis. Bethany moved as he moved through the evening, encountering each conversation as though it was entirely unlike any of the others that preceded it. In each case, after each initial barrage of "how you been, catch me up" niceties, just as the conversation forced a choice between substantive dialogue and continuing on one's way, Hollis would gesture genteelly to his side. "I'd like you to meet a friend of mine." Bethany generally took things from there, engaging them with her innocence and beauty and intelligence, lavishing Hollis with praise for his generosity and attentiveness, showing keen interest in the lives of those to whom she was introduced, laughing, smiling, radiating. Hollis watched these exchanges with a kind of prideful love, as though she was of his making, as though she reflected well on him. And after all, didn't she? Was she not his choice? Did she not reflect something in him of value? Was he not younger and more in the game than they had remembered or imagined? Still out there in the world, in motion, making deals? He watched the flicker of renewed interest come into their eyes, each and every one of them, as she spun her magic. Suddenly, the bar and the dance floor and the bathroom were less compelling objectives. They lingered. They indulged.
"Hollis, where did you ever find this one?" they said.
"Look out, Columbus," they exclaimed.
"Here's my card. I mean it now," they offered. It was the men, mostly, who then usually took their leave with a prolonged, overly sincere handshake with Bethany and a knowing wink to Hollis, or an elbow to his side. He knew what the wink meant, and the elbow jab. They were mistaken, certainly. But how could you tactfully correct such a misimpression in such surroundings? Do you reach out and grab them by the arm as they disappear into the crowd toward the bar and tell them that the relationship is really quite innocent? That, in supposing him a lowly adulterer and unfairly impugning his motives? Would they ever admit their lurid assumption? Would they even believe the denial? Wouldn't they simply take his concern about their opinion as confirmation? Who really cared anyway? Who really gave a damn? So each time, Hollis let it go, winking back, jabbing back, shooting them with his finger, winking again. What was the harm? What the hell? And they moved on together, arm in arm, to the next square yard of ballroom, to the next person, to the next exclamation of, "Hollis!" Within 3 hours' time, as Saturday slinked unobserved into Sunday, the throngs had thinned considerably, and the band had lost its verve, trading swing for sap. Hollis had introduced most of those with whom he had once worked. Of those, he had falsely promised a round of golf to at least a dozen, included Wally Nunn, who had hugged Hollis and called him John, and had said that he did not want to be congratulated on his retirement.
"Stop it, John. Stop it. Don't say that. Shh."
But rather wished to be bid a hearty bon voyage as he was setting sail into his next life. Hollis had said that Wally should be careful what he wished for, and he could feel Beth laugh to herself next to him, her mirth entering his body at the place their arms connected. Wally Nunn, who resembled a sagging, distended tower of tapioca pudding, was certainly not in good health, and it was not unreasonable to suppose that he might have found the next life at any moment.
"No more numbers, John. No more meetings. From now on, only wine..."
raising his glass.
"Women,"
gesturing at Beth.
And,
pointing at Hollis.
"Golf. From now on, John, golf. 'Cause I can't sing, John. I can't. But I'm goddamn gonna live and play golf and see the world and spend money like it's water. And let all these poor bastards worry about getting things done. We paid our dues, John. We're out the other side. Free, John! Free."
Ironically, the only notable absence of the evening was that of Vernon Ash, in charge of the OFSC on-again, off-again internship program. Vernon, they learned, was quite ill with something that might be pneumonia, and that might only be the flu, but, in any event, prevented him from making the celebration. Bethany, they were told, should pay a visit to the office when Vernon was back in the pink. Several colleagues of common gender offered to notify Bethany as soon as that was possible. So they left with a handful of promises, but no deal. Outside, the early morning air was cool and refreshing and quiet in its dark, free expanse. Everything the chaotic ballroom had not been. Hollis breathed deeply as he fished the ticket out of his pocket and handed it to the valet. Bethany yawned and hugged his arm like it was a stuffed animal. He patted her hand. On the ride back, she was quiet again, staring out the window of his car at a floating landscape that was more suggestive than real. A topography of shapes that lay sleeping beyond the fields of spotlit parking lots, beneath the tarp of darkness. He looked at her, and she was suddenly the same as those dark shapes, sitting next to him in his car. Silent and breathing, and slightly melancholic, but beautifully so. It had been a long day, and she was probably tired. That, and from Bethany's perspective, Wally's retirement party had not really produced an actual discussion with Vernon Ashe about an internship. And perhaps that was disappointing. So perhaps there was some of the frustration that always went hand in hand with youthful impatience. She would learn. He would teach her to be patient. But whatever her thoughts now, Hollis did not wish to interrupt. He let her be, and they both rode in silence and felt that strange and moody intimacy that comes with not talking, with simply being in the company of another, without the need for words. From a distance, the Westin gleamed of its own incandescence, rising up beyond the banking horizon of Interstate 70 like an exotic stalk burning from within. As he pulled into the lot, Bethany turned, her hand on his arm, and the light back in her eyes. "Want to see where I've been meditating?"
"Now?"
"Sure," she said, laughing. "You can tell me if I've been facing east." Hollis parked the car and escorted Bethany into the hotel, crossing the spot in the lobby where he had first seen her that evening, before Tilly's party, emerging from the elevator bay in her own ferocious and youthful beauty, surrounded by insignia-festooned conventioneers of the kind now roaming the halls and congregating in loose, restless clots in the lobby and outside the front door. Bethany idly fussed with her hair in the mirrored walls of the elevator, pulling and teasing a strand here and a strand there, pulling her fingers through the thick of it, along the back of her head, until they disappeared like children walking in tall golden grasses, each reemerging at the top of the hill. She turned her head ever so slightly in one direction and then the other, inspecting her profile. Not that there was anything wrong or in need of fixing. It was all just unconscious grooming, instinctive self-maintenance, doing what was in her nature to do. Save for a muffled screaming and gunfire from beneath the door near the elevator, the seventh floor was quiet. Hollis followed Beth toward the end of the hall on a well-padded carpet, the color of ferrous soil. It stretched out beneath a pattern of fallen leaves and vines that interlocked and repeated and disappeared beneath the long walls. At the end of the hall, Bethany stopped and fished her fingers around in her little purse for the card key. Finding it, she closed the purse, turned, and kissed Hollis on the mouth, her hand with the card key against the back of his neck, pulling him down to her, the smell of her filling him, the length of her body exploring the distance between them. She lowered herself slowly, releasing him, separating her mouth from his, trailing the tips of her fingers along his cheek. Hollis watched her, at once from very far away as though from the wrong end of a pair of binoculars, and yet so close as to be unable to see the entirety of her face in a single glance, or to know any single thing about her in a single thought. The very idea of her was suddenly lost to him. Bethany opened the door deftly, even without looking away, her face the same as it ever was, her eyes, her lips, but not the face he knew. Without a sound, she stepped inside and disappeared. Hollis had enough presence of mind to stop the door from closing, his hand extending as though the reflex of a crossing guard, but he did not follow her. Not for an eternity of seconds. When, at last, the door closed itself behind him, there was only the light at her back from outside the windows, the dim glow of 1,000 parking lots of Columbus in the distance, and of the moon beyond Columbus, like a cold yellow iris. Bethany stood on the far side of the bed, placing her earrings on the nightstand. She straightened and slipped her arms, pale and smooth and lovely, from their burnt yellow sleeves. And when the dress fell from her body, down, down, down into the darkness below the bed, it was like the sun slipping down into some boiling African sea, as the world finds the darkness that has always been waiting.